This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Late last Saturday night, the House passed a trillion-dollar package that its sponsors say would be the most dramatic expansion of health coverage since Medicare and Medicaid. Tens of millions more would be able to get coverage. Insurance companies would no longer be allowed to refuse coverage to people with pre-existing conditions or drop coverage when somebody gets sick. But the bill has its critics, mostly on the right. Republicans say it costs too much, doesn't control costs, and vastly expands the government role in health care. Some critics on the left agree it's way too complicated, and some object that it goes beyond current law to restrict access to abortion. If you want to know what's in this bill and what isn't, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. In a few minutes, we'll also talk about the next step and what's likely to happen when health care goes to the Senate. Later in the program, a Veterans Day visit to Arlington National Cemetery and a new history called On Hallowed Ground. But first, NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner joins us here in Studio 3A. Julie, always good to have you on the program.
Always nice to be here.
And one of the most controversial elements of this bill is the so-called public option, but there are about 87 different versions of the public option. Which one ended up in the House version of the bill?
Yes, there are. And boy, if you think there's a lot of jargon in healthcare, there's a set of jargon just for the public option. So the public option that finally ended up in this bill is what we call the less robust version of the public option. This is the public option.
Sounds like we're arguing about coffee blends.
Yeah, pretty much. Yes, this is kind of the not the French roast, if you will, the milder version. This public option would have to pay for itself, and the plans would have to negotiate rates with hospitals, doctors, and other healthcare providers, rather than pay rates that would be tied to Medicare. That would be the robust version. Mm-hmm. That basically they would pay either Medicare plus 5% or Medicare plus 10%. Now the sponsor of the bill had to do that to win the votes of at least some of these moderate deficit hawk blue dog Democrats. Interestingly, those negotiated rates save less money than the Medicare rates would have, but those blue dogs tend to come from areas where Medicare rates are kind of low. And so what turned out to happen is that the blue dogs were more worried about their healthcare providers, mostly their hospitals, saying that they were going to be underpaid if that public plan was linked to Medicare. So in the end, their deficit hawk worries were trumped by their worries from their own providers. And we ended up with this negotiated rate public plan rather than the Medicare-linked public plan. So that was the public plan that ended up in the bill.
And two of the major goals of this legislation were to include as many people as possible. How many more people would now get health care coverage? Would it include everybody?
It would not quite include everybody. Of course, illegal immigrants, which is another big hot-button issue, will not be eligible for subsidies under this bill. So they will not be eligible for any of the benefits under this bill. They will, and this did not get changed, they will be eligible to go into these new insurance exchanges and buy coverage with their own money. That was something that a lot of Republicans had wanted to change, but in the end, that is still in there. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 36 million more people will be able to get insurance or will be estimated to get insurance at the end of 10 years. That's about 96% of the legal population at the end of that time. So most people, not quite everybody.
Another thing that the spiraling cost of health care has been a major motivating factor behind all of this, well, for the past 20 years and more, the fact is, does this control the escalation of costs?
Yes and no. It does pay for itself. That was one of President Obama's absolute, you know, said he will not sign a bill that does not pay for itself. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, it even lowers the deficit a little bit. I think in the last year, it lowers it by $10 billion, which is...
Hey, a billion here, a billion there.
Yeah, soon you're talking about real money, but not when you spend $2.2 trillion a year on health care. That's not a lot of money. It mostly pays for itself in traditional ways, reducing payments to health care providers and Medicare. Biggest chunk of that is actually taking back extra money that the Republicans gave to Medicare managed care plans in the 2003 Medicare drug bill. It also pays for this bill with a tax, surtax on high earners, millionaires in terms of couples, people earning more than $1 million, $500,000 for individuals. What it does not do is what they call bending the curve on healthcare costs, really changing the way healthcare providers are paid to encourage them to be more efficient really encouraging consumers, healthcare consumers, to want to consume less healthcare. There are a lot of demonstration projects in this plan, things like medical homes where people could go sort of one-stop shopping for medical care, accountable health organizations, which would, you know, have lots of different kinds of healthcare providers under one roof to make care more efficient. But again, those are more demonstration projects, not the kinds of fundamental changes that a lot of health economists had hoped for in this bill.
Let's see if we get some callers' questions in. Our guest is, of course, Julie Rovner, NPR's health policy correspondent. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Roger's with us from Tallahassee.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is twofold. I currently purchase my own private health insurance. I took early retirement. I purchased insurance for a family of three. It's very good coverage, but it's quite expensive. So my question is twofold. Well, am I now going to be taxed on this health coverage that I pay for? And secondly, is there any chance there'll be some downward pressure on this current the rates that I pay? It's my single largest monthly expense for a family of three is health care, and we are extraordinarily healthy.
Well, he's got what I guess would qualify as one of those Cadillac health insurance plans, but nevertheless, it's not income, is it, Julie, if he's paying for it himself?
No. The short answer to his question is no and yes. The taxing of expensive plans is not in the House bill. They're talking about it in the Senate bill. If you're self-employed, you do get a tax deduction right now. That would not change. And in fact, if you are self-employed buying your own insurance, you will be eligible to go into this exchange. And the idea of having this exchange is that there will be less expensive plans, there will be competition, there will be this public plan, if the House bill prevails, that you'll be able to choose from, and presumably you will be able to get less expensive coverage. So this should all be, if this plan were to become law, this would all be good for this caller.
Roger,
great.
Congratulations.
Now, great. Thank you. One question is, I'm currently retired. I took early retirement at age 55. I am not working. Do I have to somehow create myself as being self-employed?
Oh, no. As long as you're buying individual coverage, your own coverage, you're still eligible to go into the exchange. The rule is that you not be eligible to get coverage from an employer. You can go into the exchange.
Great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for the call, Roger. Let's go next. This is Stephanie. Stephanie with us from Granville, Ohio.
Hello. I have a question. I have what I consider to be typical insurance coverage through my husband's employer. It's not a premium plan by any means. Our premiums have been going up, as has our deductible, so each year I'm more frustrated at open enrollment time, but it is good insurance. I'm wondering, how does this bill affect me? Will it affect me? What will it do to my rate?
Julie, I think that's a question a lot of people have.
Yes, and this is where the answer becomes, it depends. It depends how large the employer is. Small employers will be eligible to go into this exchange. It will gradually be open to larger and larger employers as the years go by. There are some insurance changes that do apply to everyone, regardless of the kinds of insurance they have and whether they get it from their employer. Things like there will be limits on annual and lifetime limits. You can no longer say you can only have $5,000 worth of benefits this year, or you can only have $1 million of benefits over your lifetime. That will apply to all insurance inside and outside the exchange. Things like rescissions, where an insurer can come back and say, you forgot to say that you were treated for acne on your application 20 years ago, therefore now that you have some kind of cancer that's going to be expensive, we're going to cancel your insurance. Those sorts of things will apply to everyone's insurance. So there are certain protections that will apply across the board. There are other insurance changes that will apply only within this insurance exchange. So it will depend on your employer and what kind of coverage you have to know whether you will be eligible for this new insurance in the exchange. But the hope is at least that there will be some downward pressure on all kinds of insurance, because remember, there will be far fewer people who don't have insurance. So what happens now is that the uninsured get paid for by everyone else who has insurance. It's called cost shifting. Those people go to the hospital when they're sick or hurt, and they end up being paid for by everybody else. So hopefully when those people have insurance, their own insurance, and get paid for by their own insurance, everybody else no longer has to pay from them, so everybody's coverage perhaps won't go down, but at least won't go up as fast.
May I ask one further question?
Sure.
So you don't see it as applying to my premiums or my deductibles?
Well, your premiums and deductibles are going up every year, and what she's suggesting is that they won't be going up by so much every year. Am I getting that right, Julie?
You're getting that right.
Well,
now.
Then may I just make one final comment? That kind of smacks to me like a couple years ago when we had $4.50 a gallon gas, and airlines started charging for baggage because, hey, their fuel costs were so high they had to recoup the cost for baggage. Well, now gas has gone back down, but they're still charging for baggage because they found a way to make extra money. The idea that the healthcare industry, which already is out for money, is going to suddenly go, oh, well, now we're going to ease up on everyone, sounds kind of ludicrous to me.
Well, you're not alone in that, Stephanie. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Appreciate it. And here's an email we have from Marcia in Kansas City. My husband and I are covered by a good employer-provided health care plan. However, my husband had a kidney transplant 3 years ago. It was very successful. He's in good health, relatively. However, anti-rejection meds and ongoing checkups would be impossible for us to cover without health care. Yet, when we checked into getting coverage on our own several years ago, when there was a potential of a workplace move where health insurance was not provided, we were told he was uninsurable outside of a group or employer-paid health care plan. With this new plan, do we have an option outside of one of us working for a larger employer who provides a good health care plan with the cushion of lots of employees participating?
Yes, that is exactly the kind of person that this plan and certainly the Senate bill that is aimed at banning exclusions based on pre-existing conditions exactly like that. That all plans will be barred from saying that people are uninsurable because they have been sick. That's the trade-off. Everyone will be required to have coverage, but in exchange, people who have been sick will be able to get insurance. They won't be charged anymore. They won't be able to be charged higher premiums because of that. And they will be able to go anywhere, either within this marketplace or in a small group or somewhere else, and be able to get that kind of insurance coverage.
Julie Rovner, NPR health policy correspondent, is with us here in Studio 3A as we're talking about what's actually in the House health care bill that passed late Saturday night by a vote of 220 to 215, numbers we're going to remember for a very long time. But nevertheless, just the first of four critical votes that health care would have to pass before it would end up on President Obama's desk. So, in any case, if you have questions about what's in the bill or what isn't, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about health care and what is actually in that House bill that passed on Saturday night by a vote of 220 to 215. NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner is with us. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Ron, as we're talking about what's in the House version of the bill, nevertheless, we're also talking about politics, and it was Sunday morning when Republican Lindsey Graham pointed to that number, 220 to 215, and says, this bill is dead on arrival in the United States Senate.
Yes, but it would have been dead on arrival in the United States Senate if the vote had been 250 to correspondingly fewer. There was never any chance that the Senate was going to consider many of the elements that are in this particular bill. For example, the tax increase that Julie was describing a few moments ago, that's a non-starter in the Senate. And there are many other elements of this bill, including, of course, most notoriously, the public option.
Because one of those 60 votes in the Senate, you need a 60-vote majority to avoid a filibuster. One of those 60 votes the Democrats would be counting on, that's Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, says if there's a public policy, a public option, he's not going to let it get to the floor.
Now, of course, there is a public option apparently going to be in whatever version Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, brings to the floor. He has made that announcement. He has said he's going to meld the bills that came from the Senate Finance Committee and the Senate Health Committee in such a fashion as to include a public option with a state opt-out provision so that states that don't want to have that don't have to have that. But it's clear that's not satisfying the people in the Senate who are in the middle between the two parties' mainstreams and who are saying they just really don't want a public option. So it's awfully hard to see how the House version of a public option, which does not have a state opt-out, would fly in the Senate.
And let me ask you one more question before we get back to callers and emails, and that is we were talking a lot throughout the summer, and now we're well into the fall, about the timing of this bill, that if it runs too late, President Obama is going to start running out of options.
You know, another big factor in all this, in the consideration of how badly the White House wanted to move health care before August, and then if it wasn't going to be before August, then certainly before November, because of the change in the political climate that comes with the off-year elections. And even if you took the rosiest possible view of what was going to happen in New Jersey and Virginia, it was hard to imagine that at least one, probably both of those, were going to go Republican this year. They usually do the year after a presidential election. They usually go to the opposite party. And that was going to sap some of the notion of political power out of this administration and this Democratic majority in the Congress. And that's pretty much what we've seen happen, fairly or unfairly. Whether that's a good perception or not, that is the general perception. And that makes it a little bit harder to ask Democrats to make tough votes.
And we've already seen, let's talk politics here, Julie, the STUPAC amendment. This is the amendment that affects abortion. And we're hearing not just the extension of the Hyde Amendment, named for Henry Hyde of Illinois, the longtime pro-life advocate from the state of Illinois, but rather goes beyond that in terms of limiting abortions.
That's right. Now, there are two pieces to how this abortion amendment works. One of them obviously applies to federal funding in this new public plan, and those would be federal dollars, and that would actually make permanent for the first time. Now, remember, the Hyde Amendment is in an appropriations bill. That's an annual spending bill, and it says really no dollars for any money that comes through the Department of Health and Human Services for abortion. That's been basically renewed every year since 1976. So every year that goes into the bill. This would make it permanent for the first time. But this goes a step further and says that within this exchange, these new marketplaces, no money that goes to subsidies for private plans could be used for abortion. So in essence, what you have is that anybody in these exchanges choosing from among these plans, if they get subsidized, and remember the subsidies go up to that people earning about $88,000. So most of the people in these exchanges will be getting some kind of subsidy. They could not choose a plan that offered abortion as a benefit. Now, what people in the abortion rights community are saying is that what that would end up is that no plan would end up offering abortion, because they could potentially offer plans that offered abortion and plans that didn't. But there are other requirements within the bill that say you can't offer discriminatory benefits that would make that illegal. So in essence, you would have these exchanges and there would be no abortion ever available as a benefit. And so you would have people coming in with their own money who weren't getting subsidized, and they wouldn't be able to get abortion at all. So you're now saying that people, not just with federal funds, but people buying private policies with private funds, would not be able to get abortion as a covered benefit.
And Ron, we've already seen some conservative Democrats in the Senate say, this looks good to me. I'd like to vote for that.
That's right. But you've also seen a number of liberal Democratic senators saying there's no way we're going to allow this bill to be used to restrict women's access to choice or access to abortion. The word rights gets thrown around a good bit here, although I think Julie is absolutely right to use the word access. We're not talking about whether or not somebody has a right to an abortion, but we're talking about whether or not it can be paid for through these plans.
Well, let's get some callers' questions back. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Norman from Cleveland in Ohio.
Hi. I'm getting insurance. I'm a self-employed musician, and I'm getting. Am I allowed to say the plan that I have? It's a health maintenance plan, and I'm pretty happy with it.
All right, sure.
Okay, well, I've got Kaiser, although Kaiser isn't available every place. You know, and portability is the thing that bothers me, and also the price that I'm paying, you know, like $580-something a month for a single person with a couple of curses. High blood pressure and things like that. Would I be able to do this public option if I already have insurance? Am I allowed to switch?
Julie, would he be allowed to switch?
Absolutely, he'll be allowed to switch. The idea of this exchange is that you will have a choice of presumably several plans, not clear entirely how many, but a multiple of plans with the public option, and assuming the House bill were to prevail, the public option would be one of them. If Kaiser's available in your area, probably Kaiser would be one of them too. And you could choose from among the plans. There would probably be a national plan that would be available so that if you travel a lot as a musician, you would be able to get benefits around the country. But that's the idea, is to give you more choice and possibly or probably better prices.
Sure. I don't understand how people who have local Blue Cross and things like that, what happens when they retire and go to Florida, and if they have pre-existing stuff, what do they do? I can't.
If they're 65, they get Medicare.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you very much,
okay.
Norman.
Okay.
Email from Mark in Columbus, Ohio. Is there anything that would keep my employer from just saying, go join an exchange and stopping the insurance they're paying for now?
Yes, there are. There's a requirement in the bill for employers to continue to either continue to provide the insurance or pay a certain percent of payroll.
Yet, Ron, this is one of the major arguments of Republicans. There are so many incentives in this plan that eventually it's going to drive everybody towards the public option, and this is effectively a government takeover.
Yes, the key word there is effective. Is it true that if this mechanism exists, that mechanism will, quote, take over, unquote? And takeover is a wonderful phrase to use if you're trying to kill something, because in our politics we are generally quite leery of anything that involves the government taking over. So it has been a theme of the Republican opposition throughout the year to portray the bill as a total takeover. Now, of course, if you're Dennis Kucinich, one of the other people who voted against the bill in the House.
Liberal Democrat from Cleveland.
That's right. He ran for president in 2008 as a liberal. And he says, no, the problem with this bill is that there isn't enough government in it, that it leaves too much of the for-profit insurance industry standing. And what we really should have is a simple single-payer system such as in Canada. And that has many fans in the United States. It has many fans in the United States. But that's not what this bill is, yet that's what the Republicans are arguing against.
Let's get another call. Julie, I'm sorry.
I should point out that people need to be careful. Employers can end up putting their employees into the exchange. That won't necessarily put their employees into the public plan.
Option, yeah.
Right. The public option will only be one option within the exchange. There will be many more private plans available than there will be a public plan.
Well, speaking of Cleveland, we have another caller from there. Charlene.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for the conversation. I'm on Medicare. That's my only form of insurance. And I guess I've been hearing different things about how Medicare is going to be impacted. One, they're going to, cut back on a lot of funding, that's now in there they consider to be wasteful. So can you speak to anything in this bill that would impact or change the Medicare?
Yes. Obviously, this is where politics and policy intersect. The Democrats who put this bill together know that in the 2010 midterm elections, seniors vote in disproportionate numbers. So they have been very careful.
Even more
disproportionate numbers. So they have been very careful not to hurt people who get Medicare. So, yes, they are taking money out of Medicare, but they are giving benefits to lots of people on Medicare. They are, for one thing, closing the donut hole. This is where people who have the Medicare drug benefit stop getting benefits after they spend a certain amount of money and then have to pay all of their own drug expenses for several thousand dollars. There are new preventive benefits for Medicare beneficiaries. The only people who could end up losing some benefits are the people who are getting extra benefits now because they're in these Medicare managed care programs. And some of those plans are going to be losing some of those extra money, some of the extra money that they get. And that extra money is shared with the beneficiaries in the form of extra benefits. So if they lose that extra money, so some of those beneficiaries could lose some of those extra benefits. But beyond that, no beneficiaries are going to lose benefits that they have now. And in fact, within this bill, there are new benefits for Medicare beneficiaries.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Stephen. I'm in my mid-30s, self-employed. I cannot afford health care. If this bill passes the Senate, will there be any provision for me to receive free health care or deeply discounted health care? And will I be required to purchase health care in the future, no matter what the cost, or receive some sort of penalty?
Answer to the last question is no. There will be hardship exemptions for people who truly cannot afford it. There will be a sliding scale of subsidies for people depending on what they earn. If you earn less than 150% of poverty, for the first time, everyone will be eligible for
Medicare. What's poverty just right now?
I think it's Ooh.
For a single person?
I think for a single person, it's about $9,000, I believe.
Okay.
So
150% would be $14,000.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Still a very small
number. Yes, it's still very small. But the subsidies go all the way up, as I said, to 400% of poverty for a family of four, which is $88,000. So the subsidies go way up the scale. So under 150% of poverty, you are eligible for Medicaid. No matter, it used to be Medicaid has always been what we call a categorical program. You have to fit into a category, either a single mother with a pregnant with a child or age blind or disabled. From now on, all you have to be is poor, and you will get Medicaid under 150% of poverty. Over that, you will get subsidies. If there will be a certain amount, there will be thresholds. If you can prove that you still can't afford the coverage that's available, you can get a hardship waiver. Other than that, you will be then required to buy a plan. And if you don't, then there will be a penalty up to 2.5% of your modified adjusted gross income.
But that's imposed by the IRS, presumably?
Imposed by the IRS.
And is there, if you... This specter has been raised that if somehow you avoid that, if you don't buy coverage, you could end up in jail.
You could end up in jail to the same extent you can end up in jail if you don't pay your taxes now. I mean, if you were convicted of, tax fraud.
But, or evasion,
Or tax evasion, you could end up in jail. But the IRS in general, people who evade their taxes usually are dealt with on a civil matter.
End up in high dudgeon, not Leavenworth.
Yes. Right. You end up in high dudgeon, not Leavenworth.
We're talking about health, what's in the House version of the health care bill and about its prospects in the United States Senate with Julie Rovner and Ron Elving. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go next to Norm. Norm with us from Titusville in Florida.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. I wanted to ask your guest, does this bill or any parts of this bill include dental care? And if not, why isn't dental care included as overall health care and covered the same way that you would cover any other medical procedure?
Well, Julie has beautiful teeth, but Julie, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, and they are mine. That comes up a lot. Actually, dental and vision care, I believe, are included in the high option plan. There's a sort of a low, medium, and high option plan in the basic benefits package. They are not in the lower option plan. I've gotten tons and tons.
Are there limits set on that?
I don't know if there are dollar limits set on that, or I don't think it goes to that level of detail, just that they will include, that the high option plan will include dental and vision care. I know that there's lots of concern about the relationship of oral health to the rest of health care, and that it really ought to be in there. You know, traditionally, dental health has been sort of an add-on to the rest of health care coverage, and an awful lot of people think that that's a mistake, but it is expensive, and traditionally it hasn't been, and I know that that's still a source of some debate.
Well, with the heart transplant, liver transplant is expensive, but
I'm not arguing it. I'm just telling you what the bill says. I didn't write the bill.
Would have writer's cramp, let me tell you that. By the way, we just got some numbers. The poverty guidelines, $22,000 for a family of four and $10,800 for one person. So
Thank you.
What it is at the moment. We just have a couple of minutes left. What is your best guess, Ron Elving, as this goes to the Senate? They're going to be trying to meld the two versions, very different versions that came out from the Health Committee and from the Finance Committee. We're supposed to see something, this week?
Possibly. There could be something tomorrow or Friday. Of course, today is a holiday. But we don't really necessarily expect to see it tomorrow or Friday. I think it's more likely that we'll see a bill in the Senate next week. They have promised to put it out there for a reading. That is to say, a literal reading, a chance for people to actually hear what's in the bill, read what's in the bill. We don't know exactly how long it will be, but it's not going to be much shorter, I don't think, than the House's 2,000-page job. So it's going to be a daunting prospect to read it aloud, to read it to oneself. It's going to be an opportunity for people to read it, so at least that particular criticism can't be leveled against it. And then they're going to start debate.
And we don't know where that's going to go, but it's likely that, as you suggest, this is going to be a very different bill than what the House has come up with.
That's right. Although we shouldn't overemphasize the differences. I think we want to make it clear that what went through in the House is going to be substantially changed, but we don't want to make it sound as though these are completely apples and oranges. They're not. They have a great number of provisions in common and many things that can be easily compromised.
And, Julie, we keep hearing that from a lot of people, saying, we all agree on about 85% of this.
That's right. Well, the Republicans like to say that they agree on 85% of it. I think that's not true. But I think the Democrats in the House and the Democrats in the Senate do agree on about 85% of this. It's really just the public option is a big source of disagreement. How you pay for it is a big source of disagreement. But, you know, the idea of having these exchanges, taking care of pre-existing conditions, having this individual mandate, that's a big, big deal. Those kinds of threshold things, those are things that are the structure of these programs are basically the same.
And if you had to be a betting person, would you say that the odds that President Obama will find a bill on his desk at the end of the day, did those odds improve on Saturday night when the House passed its version?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the first time ever that a House of Congress has passed a major health overhaul bill. You know, then they've been trying for 100 years. So even though it didn't pass by very much, it passed. That's a big deal.
We'll have to see its prospects in the Senate. And when we see that bill, and Ron Elving will insist that you read every single word of it, and you'll come back and talk about what's in that version of the bill. And then we'll start talking about our favorite word, reconciliation. Ron Elving, NPR's political editor here with, senior Washington editor here in Studio 3A with us also, Julie Rovner, NPR's health policy correspondent. We thank them both for their time today and their tireless work over the past few days on this. Coming up next, remembering the service of Americans veterans in a new book about the history of Arlington National Cemetery. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.